Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week wherever you are listening. I want to say a huge, huge, massive thank you for your reaction to the book cover and the fact that we've got a date now. It's coming out January 2023. Thank you so much for your amazing comments and your amazing pre-orders. It makes such a huge difference to a book if you pre-order it. I know that seems a strange thing, but it all counts for the first week of sales. So if you have ever enjoyed the show, if I've ever helped you in any way, I would be hugely, hugely grateful if you could pre-order the book. That would be amazing. The link is in my Twitter bio at The Griefcast, and it's on Instagram as well at The Griefcast. Thank you so much if you've done so already. It's been truly, truly heartwarming, and thank you. This week I'm talking to the incredible writer Ella Risbridger. Ella is the author of Midnight Chicken and Other Recipes Worth Living For, and her brand new book, The Year of Miracles, Recipes About Love and Grief and Growing Things, was published in May this year and is available to buy now. Ella is a beautiful writer. It is a cookbook. There's some amazing recipes in it, but it's surrounded by these incredible, beautiful essays and just lovely, beautiful drawings. I'm overusing the word beautiful, but it really is a very beautiful book, Year of Miracles, and it is all about the grief that she has experienced and how she used cooking and food to kind of find her way through that. She's such an interesting person, and I loved talking to her so much. The way she expresses what she's been through and what happened to her is, really moving and a really interesting take on it, I think, especially as, I'm not someone who goes to food for comfort and love, so I always find people that do really, really fascinating. And the book is, as I said, just gorgeous. I've posted about it on Instagram before, but yeah, definitely, it's a good gift for someone who is feeling in grief at the moment. I think it's a good way to feel cheery about what's happening without not acknowledging what has happened to them. Ella came in to talk to me about her partner John, who died of cancer, aged 28. Congratulations, firstly, on what couldn't be a more perfect book for a Griefcast listener. When I saw the subtitle, I was like, oh yes, sign me up, let's get involved.
It's so funny because the subtitle went through so many changes. Titles and subtitles I'm so picky about, and we had a title that was much more cooking focused, and it just didn't feel right to any of us. And it was about, you know, the recipes or whatever and the kind of recipes, and it just didn't feel right to any of us. Not to say these are recipes about grief, and it's kind of an unusual thing, obviously, because you've got that recipes about grief, but it kind of works, and I'm really glad it worked for you as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I do speak to writers on this program, often all the rest of their marketing has been like, oh, how can we hide the grief? And then with me, they're like, it's about grief. And I'm like, come in, my guys, we're happy to talk about it. But yeah, I mean, it really, I can see why that was problematic, because if you didn't mention the grief and then you bought it thinking, it's a book, a cookbook about lockdown or something. And then you were like, whoa, because it really is about, yeah, it's about grief, but not in a, I mean, you know, I always preface whenever I talk to a writer about grief on the show, like, obviously, it's not a book about constantly crying. It's just a book about surviving, really, and surviving in grief in one of the most extremely difficult years some of us have been through. The first lockdown is kind of what this book takes us from January to December.
And that was just a function of when I wrote it. I was always going to write this book. So John, my late fiancé, my late partner, died in 2018. And I went into a bit of a mad frenzy of work. Mm. So I was just constantly pitching books. And I sold this book in the August and he died in the April. And I didn't think it was going to be as much about grief as... I was in that, I don't know, you know, that denial bit where you're like, actually, I'm completely fine. No, yeah. I don't... Death has never touched me at all. I can do anything. I actually have no feelings. And then obviously it was much harder to write. And I was like, why is this book so hard to write? Why is this cheerful book about dinner parties so hard to write? And then suddenly there was a lockdown and I thought, oh, it's because it's a big book about grief.
At least you were open to that. Do you know what I mean? I think people, some people spend their lives being like, no, it's not about grief. And that's where, you know, you can still get great art from that position, but it's very difficult. And I think it can be very painful. Whereas if you just go, ugh, it's a book about grief. I've just finished my book about grief. And but luckily I went to the publishers with like, it's about grief, don't worry. And it's such a funny thing to like, to sit down and be, and have to write about it. Like, I don't know how you felt, but it's awful. It's just like, you sort of pitch it like, yeah, I can write about grief. And then you sit down to write about your grief. And you're like, oh God, why have I said I could do this? This is so upsetting. Like, I just want to watch
it's
Neighbours
so
and go to
upsetting.
Sleep.
It's so upsetting.
Yeah.
The thing about grief is, it is just so upsetting. I think because I'm a writer who writes about my feelings primarily. You know, Midnight Chicken, my first book, you know, it's a cookbook about trying to kill yourself. So I'm not really a stranger to writing about hard stuff. I'm writing about hard stuff in a way that is fun as well. Mm. In that I think people are sometimes surprised that Midnight Chicken is a cheerful book. Midnight Chicken is quite a cheerful book, even though it starts with a suicide attempt. And I think this one's quite a cheerful book, even though it starts with my partner dying horribly and very young. So I think in terms of writing about grief, I was definitely sure I didn't want to do it. I was definitely sure, because before I wrote this book and before John died, I had a column online and then in The Independent about makeup, about lipstick and grief. Lipstick and Cancer was my first column. And then it was about poetry and grief. And then it was a beauty column. And I was very personal in all of that. And because I was writing weekly about what it was like to be a carer at the age of 23, and what it was like to watch someone you loved kind of always teetering on the verge of death. I mean, I'm doing this all out of order. I haven't even said who is dead.
I know, don't worry. I know it. We'll come back in a minute, but you can finish this thought, definitely.
So basically, my partner was dying for a long time, and he was really dying for a long time. It was lots of like, oh, is this it? Is this the last bit? Oh, no, okay, we might get a week at home. So it was it was on the edge constantly. Mm. He was constantly on the verge of dying for 3 years. And so because I'd been writing about that feeling, in some ways writing about grief was a lot easier than that. It certainly felt cleaner than writing about that teetering feeling of like being about to be grieving, and also kind of preemptively grieving, and also grieving the life we'd had that didn't revolve around the cancer ward.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that, because that's the thing about grief, and people talk about anticipatory grief, which obviously does exist, and when you are caring or when someone's terminally ill, you are in the process of grieving. But until someone dies, until that door is like closed, locked, done, then your grief is hovering, is, you know, you don't know when that process is beginning. It is like the birth of a child or something. Like, until they're here, you can say all the things in the world. You can say, I'm going to feel this, I'm going to do this. You don't know. And I often speak to people who are in that stage of, about to be in full grief and they'll say things to me like, oh, I think I'm this or I've done this. And I think, you don't know until, like you said, until it's like, well, now they're dead and now I'm not, that narrative is ended.
It's funny.
And then I can begin a new story.
I actually found that easier. I found it easier to cope with than the constant hope. I found the hoping part of grief. And also the fact that I needed people to see that I was grieving something. So when John was dying and John was in hospital, I felt very strongly that our life was gone. And it was gone because he had so we'll get into it, but he had cancer and then a brain injury. And the brain injury made it really clear. It was kind of a very weird complication of the very weird treatment he had for his very weird cancer. The brain injury made it clear that he was never going to come home. And we lived in the tiniest flat on the Mile End Road in East London. It was extremely grimy and extremely small. I mean, I could literally touch all four walls of the kitchen. There was no room I couldn't like stretch out and touch all the walls of. Our bedroom fit a double bed in, and that was about it. Double bed and like a little tiny wardrobe. Awful, awful and small, but there was no way we were getting a specialist wheelchair in there.
Yeah.
And so particularly in that year, I was like, and also because when someone has a brain injury, you're kind of losing bits of them a lot and you've already, so I was like, the grief where I could get no one to see what I'd lost was so hard. I think when he died, what felt like a huge, unbelievable blessing to me was everybody suddenly seeing that everything had gone for me and everything had lost in that whole world that I had, you know, loved so much was gone. And I actually found that much easier to cope with than that anticipatory hovering, what have we lost, but what were we going to gain? Who knows what the future holds state. I find hope very difficult.
Yeah, I can really understand that. I can understand as well. It's like you said, it's hard for other people because grief is hard anyway. Grief's hard for the person grieving. And then for your surrounding support network, if they're like, oh, well, he's still here. Like, they don't know, they're not swooping in to be like, right, person's died, I'm here, here's the food, here's the love. So everyone's like, oh, they're just dealing with it. And it is then hard to kind of, like you said, I think what the phrase you used was really lovely, for people to see what's happened. So who are we remembering today?
Remembering is a funny word for me. I think because I try quite hard not to kind of think about it in remembering terms, more of a kind of like ongoing thing. Mm. I don't know. But basically the person who died was my boyfriend, my late partner, John, who died, in April 2018, after having had cancer and then a brain injury for nearly 3 years. It was very bad. I mean, I cannot stress to you enough quite how bad it all was.
Yeah. And how long were you together before he got diagnosed, before he became sick?
Before he became diagnosed. So we were only together for 3 and a bit years. We've been together for 3 and a bit years. Because we got together when I was 19 and I was 22 when he got diagnosed. But because we were kind of London, you know how you get in London, people who are kind of London babies, people who, the family is far away. My family were abroad. He wasn't at the time we met super close to his family. And kind of all our friends were these people whose parents and had very much left their hometowns and their kind of lives behind to come to London. So we were very, independent feels like a funny word, but we were a very little like tight unit of, like I think now looking back on it, I'm amazed that he stayed in London. You know, he was 25 and I was 22. That's really young. To not kind of have that ongoing family support. And I think we didn't want it, but also I'm now like, why didn't you want it?
Yeah.
We were very defensive about just doing it on our own, fixing it all. We were very little.
I think it's hard as well when, you know, so my dad died when I was 15. And I think it takes so much time to look back and see how young you are when something happens.
Totally.
Because ages I was like, oh, I'm 15. Like what? It's basically 18. It's basically 20. Like it's it doesn't matter. It's just enough. And then now, which I've talked about before on the show, if I meet a 15-year-old now, I'm like, baby, you're a tiny baby. Like, what do you think? You have any opinions that matter? You don't. You're a baby. But I can totally believe at 22, after being with someone for 3 years, you met when you're 19, like,
like you said, your unit, of course we can do this, of course we can handle it. Like, exactly. You don't see yourself in the truth often, because maybe it's too hard to see.
Totally. And I think as we'd moved in together straight away, I mean, really straight away, because I'd been living in France and my family were abroad, and I moved to London really to be with him. I said it was to go to university, but really it was because I was just, you know, 19 and in love. Yeah. So we'd formed this very domestic partnership, and we both had a lot going on mental health wise. And I think that didn't help in terms of forming kind of tight unit. But now I look at 22-year-olds, my sister just turned 22, and I'm like, what? How?
Yeah.
How could I have done? How? Why didn't I just reach out? But I think that's part of grief, I guess, and kind of part of anticipatory grief is this thing of, for me anyway, was kind of pulling in and making it, just kind of trying to form a tight unit that would be kind of a containment for it. Yeah. I was so frightened, and I think the idea of letting a lot of people in. And I say all this in the knowledge that one of the things that happened when John got sick was that we let a lot of people in that we did a lot of fundraising, a lot of awareness, a lot of chatting, a lot of talking about it. John was very funny about dying. He had a blog, and he wrote things sometimes for the paper, and he was just a very funny person, and he didn't stop being funny because he was dying and about dying.
Yeah. If you're funny in life, your death is still, like, you don't change because you've got cancer.
No, and I think what was nice when he died was feeling that there were so many funny things for various incredibly traumatic and complex reasons that I am absolutely not allowed to talk about on a podcast. We didn't get to go to the funeral. And on the day of his funeral, for very complex work reasons, we ended up having to watch, a sort of collection of us who'd loved him, the film Burlesque, starring Christina Aguilera, which inexplicably he had always maintained was the best film ever made. And we were just there like, how can it be that on this day of this like funeral, traumatic, not being allowed to go to the funeral, I cannot even tell you how traumatic it was, we're all just sitting around watching this terrible film that no one cares about, because it's like, well, for legitimate work reasons, we need to watch the film Burlesque. What? And that was very funny to me. And I found that a huge part of grieving was being able to find the kind of small, funny things that felt at the time like a sign, and now feel like, I don't know what, like comfort.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I think with things like that, it's like, if it's a sign or it's not a sign, it's just mad coincidence. Like, whatever it is, if you can find comfort in it, great. Like, it doesn't really matter what the name of it is. What matters is that you were able to, on that awful day of not being, for various reasons, to go to the funeral, were able to not, you know, smash your head into a sink and just be like, no, I can't, I refuse for this to be my life. To just sit with friends who loved you and watch a film that he thought was brilliant.
Which it really isn't.
We need to have words with him. Yeah. Like, I feel like I know him better by you telling me he would defend Burlesque as a great film. It's like, oh yeah, okay.
He had terrible opinions about almost everything, really. One of the nicest things, actually, about writing this book about him dying was because he was very, I don't know how to put it, he was very online. He was very online as a person, and he had a huge circle of well-wishers and acquaintances and kind of distant friends, and then a very, very close, tight-knit circle of people who kind of really got the very real him. Sometimes we joke that he only liked two or three people in the world, but he had masses of friends and acquaintances.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people, because when someone's dying, particularly when someone's dying of cancer and being brave about it, they kind of make them into a bit of a saint.
Yes, yeah.
A bit of a, oh, you're so brave, you're so wonderful. You know, when he died, we got a lot of messages being like, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. And I remember my friend saying, it could have happened to nicer people every day. He was not nice. And of course he was nice in lots of ways, but I really understood then the thing of being like, you know, nice was not one of his top characteristics. He was incredibly funny and generous. And one of the wonderful things about writing this book was feeling like, oh, you know what? He's been dead for four years now. I can talk about him as he was. I can talk about this kind of incredible, irascible, like, generous, giant man. I mean, he was 6'5". He was like twice as wide as me across the shoulders. And he was kind of larger than life in every possible way.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to get to write about that. It was really nice to get to write about, you know, he wouldn't eat pasta. I don't know why.
Yeah, I like that. And you said that in the book. And I was like, yeah. What? But this girl is like an amazing home cook. What the fuck is he not eating pasta for? Oh. Like, that must have made her life so hard.
He was always on a diet or very much not on a diet. He had two huge extremes. So he would either be like, let's get two pizzas each. I'm going out. I want this. I want that. Or like, so when I met him, he was on an apples and whiskey diet.
Which consists of those two things.
So he had a lot going on. And one of the wonderful things about this book was getting to sort of show people a bit what he was like as a person, not just as a person who is dying.
Yeah, I got that real sense of him in the book, especially when you, Ella, in the book, is talking to the friends who knew and loved him in that intimate circle. And like you said, remembering him in, I guess it's not like an unfavorable way, it's an honest way. And that's like so nice in grief, because I know what you mean is when everyone puts him on the pedestal and acts like they were an angel. And I felt very the same with my dad, because he really wasn't an angel. He was really like a difficult character. Fun, yeah. Interesting, arrogant, amusing, great communicator, but my God, like, could be an absolute arsehole. And the people who appreciated that side of him felt to me like then you didn't mind sharing your grief with them, because you're like, oh, okay, exactly. We're talking about the same person.
And I think there's this horrible thing when someone dies. I find it really horrible to kind of make them into this saint, make them into this kind of hero figure, to be like, oh, he died too young. It's like, yeah, he did, but also he did this and this, and he was complicated and he was real. And yeah. I find the kind of, when people kind of make a hagiography, I don't know how you say it, the thing where you make someone into a saint anyway, I find that really hard, because it takes him one step further out of being in our lives. I mean, I said earlier that I find remembering really hard, the word remembering really hard, because one of the things that has been really crucial to me in figuring out grief and understanding grief and like kind of learning how to live alongside grief in a way has been learning to kind of bring him with me in a way. I don't want to feel like he's trapped in a sort of saint-shaped box back in either 2018 when he died or in 2014 before he was ever ill. I don't want him to stay stuck there. I like the idea that he kind of shaped my whole life, and then I'm making decisions because of him, and not for him exactly, but kind of with him in my mind. Often I'll do something and I'll think, you'd hate this. You'd hate this so much. And I do it kind of because of that. I mean, just after he died, my immediate grief, which I felt like nothing at all for the first year, because I was just doing it. And then the second year, I felt like quite guilty. And now I feel like I've kind of come to an equilibrium. Just that I just kept doing things that I knew he'd hate. He had lots of bad opinions. Like, he didn't think nail varnish. He didn't like bright nail varnish. He thought it was horrible. So I just constantly painted my nails like the brightest colours I could find. I wore a lot of neon. I bought a gold sequin bikini. There was this weird heat wave. Do you remember that in like April 2018? There was a weird heat wave. And I just spent the whole time wearing like extremely short denim cutoffs and a gold, like a sequin bikini in the park. And just being like, yeah, I'm going to go out. Going to do all these things. And because he hated going out. I mean, he liked the pub, but he didn't like clubs. He didn't really like dancing. But I just felt this urge to be like, well, I'm going to live my life. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to find all the things that you would hate and do them. And it was such an interesting response. I think it was probably quite healthy, but quite mad. I think I was quite mad.
I wouldn't blame you. like dealing with that at your age. And I mean, who, even the grown-ups, as I like to think of them, people who meet grief at the right age, so to speak, go mad. So I completely understand. And I think, especially when you've been with cancer, I mean, my dad wasn't ill for very long at all in comparison, but when you've been dealing with like hospital life, it's so grim, it's so beige and grey and everyone, no one has any colour. And so I know that feeling of like after someone's died, like it's like you've come up for air, you know, you're like, and you start like really breathing, like you're like, that's, and I remember me and my mum talking about that, of like, you just want to like suddenly like live and eat good food and laugh really heartily, because you're like, I'm not fucking dead. And when you're in a hospital with someone, you start thinking like, oh, am I dying too? Because that's what
am
it feels
I,
like.
Am I also dead?
Yeah.
It was, and I think in some ways actually that's really the heart of this book. There's this recipe in the book for dukkah. They're like Middle Eastern, like spice mix.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
I left that recipe out. I kept taking it out, putting it in, like writing different introductions, because I was really scared of what people would think, because it's very much about how after John died, I had this incredible urge to fill everything with colour.
Mm.
I mean, my life had become so beige. I wore the same thing every day, basically, for 3 years. I had like two pairs of jeans and two hospital jumpers. I literally just like wore the same thing every day, basically. And then I would try and put lipstick on. By the end, I was so tired of it. I was so tired of wearing makeup, so tired of trying to put on a brave face.
Mm.
And it was all so beige, apart from this lipstick, which by the end had come to feel like an obligation, like a thing I was doing to show that I wasn't going to give up on him or on us, even though I kind of knew that maybe giving up on us and giving up on him was the right thing to do. You know, he was very unwell and he was very sick, and he was a person who had been very clear before his brain injury about what would make a life worth living for him. And obviously it's not the same for everyone, but for him, the things he loved were like being the most interesting and the most exciting and the most like capable person in a room, the person everyone was looking at. And he had always been very clear that he was unable to speak, really. He had aphasia, and then he kind of got it back a bit, but he was still really struggling, and and that was the best case scenario, that he would always really struggle, and he had lots of physical health complications as well. And so even though I kind of knew that the moral thing to do was maybe to stop fighting so hard and maybe to stop hanging on and being like, no, it's okay, we're going to get exactly back to the flat, somehow we're going to get you out of this wheelchair so that we can go home to our house, which can't have a wheelchair in it, and we don't really have the money for a house that could, and we don't have any of the things, and actually everything you love, like being very drunk and smoking a lot, is not compatible with these many, many drugs you now have to live on. So I think I was like doing this awful double act close to the end of, like, I couldn't be bothered with clothes, and I was just like wearing horrible beigey jumpers, and just, you can see I'm just like grabbing my wrists with like horrible cuffs of jumpers, and just all that, so drab, drab, drab. And we spent a lot of time in hospitals, and then towards the end, like a lot of time in intensive care and tight, like high, what do they call it, high dependency
units. High dependency units, yeah.
That kind of stuff, which is so drab. And obviously it's quite common now. People know about it, which was so weird when COVID started, and suddenly everyone knew about like staying away from people and washing your hands and wearing a mask. And I was like, wow, this was my whole life. I found it very triggering, actually, suddenly to be back in that world of like washing your hands and
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, after he died, I had this urge, like, I must fill my life with colour. If I don't fill my life with the kind of gold sequins and neon, and it was almost like I had to remind myself why I had to keep living. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that is what this recipe about dukkah is about this idea of bright colours and big flavours and salt and spice and, like, it's got various spices in it that kind of stain your fingers. And one of the things that was gorgeous in the book was getting Elisa, our illustrator, and Anita, our designer, and they've literally splashed the page with orange. And there's like beautiful like oil and pastel splashes of orange everywhere. And it's so bright and vivid. And it's an essay that is quite short, but very much about death. And it's so bright. And I was so worried that people would... I feel better about it now. But for a long time, I was really worried that people would judge me for the brightness of it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, maybe that's what held me back with the subtitle as well, was like, I'm interested to see how people feel about the fact this is a very neon book.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
But I think that's so important, and that's also what I've had with this show. Like, the logo for this show is, like, bright orange and blue. And there's an umbrella, because, like, yeah, it's about grief. And, you know, they're kind of... But I remember speaking to my designer and an artist I've worked with a lot called Jade Perkin about this logo. And she lost her mum, and both of us were very, like... Our grief was not constant weeping. Our grief wasn't walking around... elegantly being sad. Like, that's not what our grief looked like. So I wanted this show and that logo to reflect that, and I felt like it's so interesting because when I saw, obviously my proof copy looks very different, but when I saw the proper copy and how bright, I didn't even think, oh gosh, that's bright. Because for me, again, it's like what we're saying about when you sainthood someone who's died. It's like when you sainthood the grieving and make them like these wonderful people that just walk around, you know, dabbing their eyes and saying wise things.
Oh, you're
like,
so right. You're so, you know, right.
It's not true. And that's also why I can relate to that, I guess, with you, with spice and colour. Like, that's what happened to me with comedy. Like, I wanted to, like, make jokes, like, a lot of jokes, as many jokes as possible, and watch comedy and really laugh about what had happened because I didn't know how else to deal with it. And it was so awful that I felt like if you just focused on that bit of, well, you know, your dad dies, it's like, well, that's just so fucking awful. But if you can, like, throw in this, the weirdness, like watching Burlesque, all this other stuff that happens... it just balances out, and it's that's truthful, because every day wasn't a constant weeping. You know, you have to have the boring conversations, and people do make jokes and you do laugh. And for me, with the comedy, this is my theory. I have no scientific backing for it, but I felt like when you laugh, you get so much more oxygen into your lungs. Like, you really have to take big gulps. And it felt like that was me being like, you're allowed to breathe. Like, you're not in the hospital anymore. You can do this. You can take these huge gulps of laughter in. That's okay. Because for a brief moment in my life, everything had been paused and everything had been like, this is, you know, the worst thing that's ever happened. And it's a weird place to be when the worst thing that, you know, the worst thing that's ever happened to you has happened and you're still standing at the end of it. You're still there going, totally. Well, I'm still here. What do I do? Just every day get down on my knees and cry? Or do I put lipstick on, get dressed, have a shower, eat a chocolate bar? Like, all these other things have to happen.
I was so surprised that I was still alive. Yeah. I was so surprised that I was still alive and somehow had to keep living. And I so know what you mean about jokes, because I really hope this book is funny. It has got jokes.
It is funny.
I tried really hard. I was like, this. It was obviously very terrible, but it was funny in lots of ways. It was funny, and it was funny to find myself in that situation. It was like, it wasn't funny to be a quasi widow at 25, but it was interesting, and there were funny elements.
Yeah, but I think that's what people find hard with grief. Like you said, because if they're not in the club, as we say on the show, there's a way that they want the grief to look and they want it to be. And anyone sort of not being that makes people feel uncomfortable, because they're like, no, grief is this. And they want you to put you in a box. And they want the dying person to have been perfect, and they want them to have been nice and wonderful. And they were too young. It should never have. Oh, how awful. Like, they used to say about my dad all the time of, it was so good, it was quick. He would have hated to have been ill for so long. He would have hated it. And I remember thinking, you're right. Like, he was a very, like, you know, he was a marathon runner. He was a triathlete. Like, he would have really hated to have been out of action. But also, would he? Like, would he have liked longer to live? Would we have liked longer? It's just this way that people are trying to find something that makes them feel better. You know,
I found that so hard. I found people making themselves feel better to be really unbearable. I mean, the thing is with cancer is it happened constantly. I truly remember seeing someone, I think it was on Twitter, saying about their partner after, you know, John said on Twitter, I have cancer. And, you know, it was really bad cancer. Like, very few people have had it. They were like, yeah, most people, we don't have a prognosis. Not enough people have had this cancer. 3 weeks, 3 months, we don't know. Could, you maybe won't die. Also, chemo probably doesn't work. It was a real, like, we don't know anything about this cancer.
Yeah.
One doctor who happened to be affiliated with the hospital had seen one case of it, but a long time ago, and they didn't really have a treatment regime for it or anything. So it was very much like, we're gonna take some wild stabs in the dark here. There was a lot of, he had such brutal chemo. The reason he got the brain injury was because he had such brutal treatments for various stuff because modern chemo didn't work on it. Oh, anyway, it was absolutely endless. But I remember seeing someone say, oh, I've made my boyfriend promise he'll never get cancer and leave me. And I was like, okay, babe. I hate to tell you, I don't think it works like that. But I do think people will just grasp at anything to make themselves
better. Yeah.
And do you know what's awful is? I've definitely done it to other people.
Oh, yeah. My God. The thing you realise as you get further away from your grief, like, zero point, is you're like, oh, I thought I was like the queen of this, and then you're like, oh, I've said some really stupid shit, haven't I?
But I feel like I've said stupid stuff after. I feel definitely.
Yeah.
I have known other people have died since John, and I'm just like, what do I say? What do I do? What do I want people to think of? You know, my best school friend died the year after John.
Oh, God.
And she had been a huge, huge, huge part of our family life, really. She came on lots of family holidays, and then she'd been very, very mentally ill for a long time. And I had a lot of guilt about I was looking after John, so I couldn't be there for her. And I still regret a lot of things to do with that situation. But because I'd been close to her parents, and she had been super close to my parents and my sisters, and we loved her so, so much. And, you know, we went to the funeral and the wake, and it was wonderful to see her family and everything. And now, 3 years on, you know, the anniversary was just recently, and I was like, should I write to her parents again? And I was like, would I want that? It's like, I don't know. Do I want that? Do I want people to acknowledge the anniversary of John's death? We always call it deadiversary, and we have traditionally had a small party. But do I want people who were kind of not involved in the death to acknowledge it? And it's still like, you think that it's going to give you a pass to understanding pain. No. And it doesn't. It gives you a sense that it's much richer and deeper than maybe you previously thought, but it's not a cheat sheet.
No, I think that's it. Yeah, it can be a tough lesson. Because when you're in that first year of grief, you're like, oh, am I like this? Or you are so consumed with your grief, you know? And then
totally.
And, you know, I'm 20 plus years to my dad passing away, dying. And doing this show was the big learning curve for me, because that made me go, when I started, I was like, oh my God, you know, there's no grief I can't talk about. Like, I understand it all. And then I would hit grief. So I was like, I don't know what to say. This is so awful. I can't imagine what you went through. That's so like that. And then you realize every grief is unique, because every relationship is unique. You know, that's, you only have to look at the way siblings will grieve a parent, you know, like everyone grieves very differently. It's the same parents, they're brought up in the same household, and yet they feel very differently about it because you have a different relationship. And that's why it does, like you said, it's not a cheat sheet. It doesn't give you a free pass at all. I think it does is it deepens your empathy, and it makes you, I think it's easier when you're on the other side of the door to go, I mean, they're probably fine, or like, they seem fine, and believe it. Whereas when you are through the door, you're like, they're not fine, and they won't be fine, and nothing I say will make it fine. So even if I get it wrong, that's okay. You know, I think all you can do is think, well, what would I like? And also, I always go to people with the sort of caveat of, this might be the wrong thing. Like, I just wanted to say, I remembered it's the anniversary. Obviously, you might not want me to say that. And if you don't, that's absolutely fine. And to mean that, to not be like, it's absolutely fine. But let's be like, no. If you go, I really don't want you to talk about that grief, go, yeah, that's absolutely fine. And not be offended. Because that's the hard work that you have to do to support someone. To be like, actually listen to what they want and be dictated by that.
Yeah. And I think people do find that very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Kind of grieving, letting people grieve in their way rather than the way, we're back again to that thing of what should a grieving person look like.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, that's still a very real thing, that they think a grieving person should be sad in a very particular way and want very particular things. Whereas as I said, what I wanted was a sequin bikini and then a lot of to do a lot of cooking, which may not be everyone's way, although I really recommend sequin bikini to any
I think sequin bikini is like, I think that's universal. I feel like I could have done with the sequin. I could have done with someone being like, put this on and cheer the fuck up and just go out and stop thinking about it. I think actually that might have been quite useful if someone had insisted on it. Yeah, I mean, the book, we should say, is filled with like the most delicious looking recipes. Like, I did find that as someone in my grief, like we were in the not eating bit for quite a while, me and my mum. And I was like, God, how does she make such a delicious, like, how did she be asked to make such delicious looking things? But I can, having now married someone who equates food with love in the way you describe in the book, I have learnt that some people operate in a different way.
I think also the time in the book is quite elided. So it's 3 years condensed into one, yeah, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something else I felt really nervous about, but was kind of necessary in order for the book to work. To say, oh, this is when he died, and then we had this year, and then it was the lockdown. It would have been easier if there wasn't a lockdown, I think, to spread it out. But obviously,
damn it,
because
lockdown mucked up my book routine.
Well, obviously, because then the third year of grieving him was so weird.
Yeah, yeah. And we should talk about that. We had, when the lockdown started, I had my second child at the start, literally the start of that lockdown. So I was I was a bit all over the place. But I went to the Grievecast Twitter because everyone on is very supportive and reacts back very quickly. So I was like, is anyone else feeling griefy with this lockdown? And so many people were like, oh my God, it's so triggering. And it felt to me like, it felt like grief. Like, I was like, this reminds me of grief, except instead of it just being me and me being able to like, fuck you guys, none of you understand, everyone was going through it, which was awful. Because I was like, where are the people who are happy that make me feel like, oh, maybe one day I'll be happy?
Where are the gold bikinis?
Yes, where are the gold bikinis?
I mean, we spent a lot of time, we had a lot of small parties, my flatmate and I. We had a lot of time being like, oh, should we go to the bar tonight? And the bar, by the bar, we did mean like a kitchen, but with a candle. We bought a disco ball.
Yeah, disco ball. We bought disco. My kid, like, I'd say it was for the kids, but we really enjoyed it.
I have no kids and I really recommended it. I actually sent one to my grandparents because I was like, I think you need it. I think you need a disco ball energy in your life.
Yeah, it's like, it definitely, it gave a vibe. And then before you know it, you're putting funk on because you're like, well, I might as well like match this whole vibe.
But I think that's the thing. And I think that's why actually I really didn't want to write a lockdown book. Really didn't. But then, you know, actually there were a lot of parallels.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to kind of show, in a way, not to get too my art about this, but you can't see if you're listening to the podcast, but I made the little like quotation things around my art. That's not a thing I just say. I wanted to kind of show that there is a path through that kind of pain.
Yeah.
Because I saw those parallels. And because, I don't know, when we were saying earlier about they're not fine, there's nothing I can do that will make it fine, I would like to say that I am fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like it's really important. I hear a lot of, and I heard a lot of, and you will grieve forever. And I think it goes back to that thing of the tragic thing. And I think particularly when it's your partner who dies, there's a very weird thing of being like, and you will be sad forever.
Yeah.
You will always be, and I'm very different because it happened. I'm very different because he lived, and I'm very different because he died. And I would never be who I am now without it. I would never live in the way I live now. I would never have met my current partner if I wasn't this person. And, you know, the sort of deep tragic irony is that they actually, John and my current partner, had met and really liked each other. I'd never met him, but they had met in a sort of work capacity, which is mad to me. But I'm fine. And I find it sometimes the kind of thing of, you will be sad forever. I feel that there is sometimes a current of, you will never be okay. It will never be okay. And it will never be good that he died, but it always will be what happened.
Yeah.
And I have found accepting the unchanging nature of, that is just what happened, whether it was wrong that it happened or right that it happened or bad that it happened or good that it happened, in my opinion, bad, that he died very young. But it did happen, and it will always be the case that that happened to him, and kind of indirectly then his death happened to me. But it doesn't mean I'm not happy. I'm happy basically every day. And I wish someone had said to me that it was possible, because I felt very like a freak for a lot of grieving. I felt very strange and alienated from a lot of the like grief talk. because I felt like I don't want to be sad forever. I don't want to mourn forever. And I think maybe because I was so young and because he was my partner, and even, and of course he and I had talked a lot about his kind of impending death or not death or what would happen. And he was, I mean, this tells you quite a lot about him, quite brutal, and was like, nah, bring a new girl to your funeral. It'll be fine. I was like, no, you wouldn't. You've mourned me for ages. And he was like, yeah, for a bit, but you know, life goes on. And so because I knew that, I kind of always had that in my mind. And I always worry that people are going to think that what I'm saying is everything happens for a reason, which is not what I'm saying.
Just saying everything happens.
Everything happens. And then you kind of make your own reasons.
Yeah.
I feel strongly that I have made my life now into lots of reasons that John died. I try to either spite him or honour him in most things that I do. And I guess some things I'm just like, I'm sure he'd be indifferent to. Actually, he was never indifferent to anything. He was totally, absolutely, always had an opinion on absolutely every single subject, which is mad, but correct. But he's around in everything I make. I talk about him. I try to talk about him in a fun way. I don't really talk about grief very much anymore. Right after he died, I was talking about it a lot, and then I stopped.
Yeah.
I'm very glad I've got a great therapist. That's what I would say.
Yeah, always. That's the constant advice of the show. Have a good therapist. If you're delving into that box, have someone to hold your hand while you're doing it.
Do you know what? The other really good bit of advice I heard was, and this was, I think, the single best bit of advice I got, the whole thing. Don't make any irreversible decisions for 1 year.
Yes, I've heard that before. I think it's very good advice.
Don't get a tattoo. Don't buy a house. Don't have a baby. Don't even get a pet. Don't do anything you can't reverse because you are bananas. And I look at some of the things I did in that first year. I'm like, wow, all right, okay. And if someone did those to me, you know, I wrote some people letters. And I'm like, what? Okay. I had a lot of strong desires to do things that I'm now kind of like, oh, okay, I'm glad you didn't carry that through. I mean, don't do anything. Keep every responsibility to a minimum. Keep yourself alive for 1 year. After that, get your memorial tattoo. After that, buy your, you know,
across your face. That idea you've got to have a full face tattoo of their face. Go for it. But in a year, 1 year, if your friend says that to you, be like, I promise, I'll pay for it, I'll be there. But in 1 year, I think that's extremely good advice.
I don't know if anyone's talked about this on the show or whether you just know about it, but like Victorian mourning dresses.
Yes, yeah.
I think about it a lot. The idea that you like wear black for 1 year and then you wear grey for 1 year and then you go into like purples. It's like, and then you can, if you want, wear your normal clothes but with like a black band.
Yeah.
But truly, one of the things about writing publicly about grief is that people talk to me about grief.
Mm.
And often they'll come up to me after like an event. Obviously, I've not done very many, or they'll write me emails and I'm like, I had no idea. Like, you just look like a normal person and you're carrying this awful tragedy around. And so much of adulthood for me is meeting incredible people who seem super fun and we do super fun things together. And then they're like, yeah, you know, I had this terrible childhood. Or, oh, yeah, you know, my baby died. Or, oh, yeah, you know, my mum's got Alzheimer's and doesn't know who I am. Or just like a million things. Or my friend is dead. Or I have had this terrible history of eating disorders. Or everything. Everyone's got this terrible... Everyone's carrying around this mix of pain and joy all the time. And I do sometimes wonder if we all wore the black armbands, if we all wore the pretty badges, whether we might just be gentler.
I think it would be helpful. I really do. And I think there is that phrase, isn't there, of like, you know, be kind to everyone. You never know what anyone's going through. And I think especially this past couple of years, there isn't anybody that hasn't been somehow affected by something. And the idea that everybody, and, you know... It's said on social media a lot, so it feels trite, where they're like, people will do like a beautiful post and be like, look, my life's actually quite hard. Even you're like, don't post your beautiful fucking living room and then say my life is quite hard. But it's true. Like, nobody's life is perfect. Nobody's life is easy. And I think that's, on that note, Ella, that's a really good place for us all to just, take that with us. Be gentle and cook your beautiful recipes.
I hope people do.
Thank you so much, Ella, for, sharing your story and talking about John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
All of Ella's books are available to buy now. That's Midnight Chicken, and there's some other children's books and poetry books she's written as well. But The Year of Miracles, which was published this year, is available to buy
right now. You can also sign up to her Substack, ella.substack.com. You can follow us at Twitter and Instagram or at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely. It was edited by Kate Holland. The music is provided by The Glue Ensemble. The artwork is by Jade Perkin. I think that's everybody. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.